season tonight in three arenas around the country. The Boston Celtics open defense of their 17th championship against the visiting Cleveland Cavaliers, while the Chicago Bulls are getting set to host the Milwaukee Bucks, and the defending Western Conference champion LA Lakers are preparing for the visiting Portland Trailblazers. In NHL action, the Chicago Blackhawks have 3 days to nurse the wounds from last night's 3-2 loss to Minnesota before they're back in action to host the Dallas Stars on Friday. The St. Louis Blues, meanwhile, have been off since their 4-0 win over the Florida Panthers. They'll be back on the ice Thursday night to take on Carolina. And the Chicago Bears are getting ready for Sunday's game against the winless Detroit Lions. The Bears aren't perfect at 4-3, but that's good enough for first place in the NFC North. That's sports.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
Coming up today on The World from PRI, starting a business in Afghanistan is not easy, especially if you're a woman. But one woman there has found success importing gasoline for service stations in western Afghanistan. An Afghan entrepreneur in a headscarf. That's during the day's global news on The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock. India is celebrating Diwali, the festival of lights. It's a little like New Year's. People set off fireworks, they feast and party and give one another gifts. But this year, a shadow has fallen over the festival season because of recent bombings. Philip Reeves, the NPR correspondent in India's capital, reports on how many are spending the holiday this year.
Every seat in this cavernous conference hall in New Delhi is taken. Every person in those seats has a small Indian flag. They wave their flags in time as they sing India's national anthem. Some are dabbing tears from their eyes. This is a gathering of the All India Anti-Terrorist Front. It's marking its annual Anti-Terrorist Day a few days before Diwali. We salute Mother India, the audience cries. 6 weeks have elapsed since New Delhi was hit by multiple bombs that killed 21 people. Four big Indian cities have been bombed this year. Nearly 130 people have been killed. The Delhi police band strikes up as the organizers summon onto the stage a disheveled, bewildered-looking woman. She lost her father in the Delhi blasts. She's presented with a trophy and a check. A small girl with a strangely fixed smile is asked to sing. Her name is Manisha Michael. She's 11 years old. Last month's bombings were not the first in this city. Manisha lost both her parents in a blast 3 years ago. The Anti-Terrorist Front's leader takes the podium. Kill the terrorists and throw away their bodies, says MS Beta. People in Delhi are no longer safe, he says, and they feel afraid.
The fear, of course, there is in Delhi because the festive season is coming, Diwali is coming.
That's Manisha Dubey, master of ceremonies at this event.
I've seen the markets are all vacant. The people, they don't have the enthusiasm about the festival as usual. So I think it does affect the people, and the fear is, of course, there.
India's security services are convinced the Delhi bombings were the work of Islamist militants. Manisha Dubey agrees.
I think outsiders have come in here in India, and there are some less educated people in India. So, you know, they just do the brainwash, and they make them realize that whatever you are doing, you're just doing for jihad.
When its cities are bombed, India usually points an accusing finger at Pakistan and its intelligence services. However, these days, attention's focused on radical Indian Islamist organizations, including a mysterious group called the Indian Mujahideen. It claimed last month's Delhi bombings. A few days after those attacks, something strange happened. The police raided a building in the city. Two Indian Muslims, both students, were shot dead. A police inspector also died. This is the village where those two students came from. It's some 400 miles from Delhi, deep in the rural plains of North India. India has a huge Muslim minority, roughly 160 million people. Two-thirds of this village are Muslims. They live in a district called Azamgarh in Uttar Pradesh state. India's media has begun labelling the place as India's terror capital. Yet the village looks no different than thousands of others. It's a cluster of tumble-down shops, brick homes, and stagnant ponds where pigs and water buffalo mingle with the village kids. Mohammed Zahid's sitting outside while his friends commiserate him. His 17-year-old brother, Sajid, was one of the two students the police killed.
You can imagine how it would feel if a 17-year-old child from your family was sent with so much hope to Delhi and was killed for no fault of his. It's terrible.
Mohammed suspects his brother was the victim of what's known in India as a fake encounter, in which the police inspector was somehow killed by mistake. A fake encounter is another term for an extrajudicial killing carried out by the police. Such killings by South Asia's beleaguered security forces are fairly common. Mohammed says his family's now paralysed by grief and anger.
We're angry because they call us terrorists, and we're also angry because they refuse to set up a commission to look into this case.
The family want a judicial inquiry. They're not alone. Salman Sultan is a teacher here at Shibli College in Azamgarh. He's among a number of civil society activists, including many non-Muslims, calling for an investigation. Locals say a handful of other Muslim youngsters from the area have disappeared. They think they've been detained by the police. Sultan says this is causing a lot of worry in the community.
Many parents now, they are just keeping their children at home. When they come back, we just, we are very happy that they have come back. So living in this environment, I mean, what kind of democracy is this? When you are living in this dreadful environment.
I am worried, and many people here are worried.
Islamic scholar Ishtiaq Ahmed Zilli fears the crackdown on Muslims in the aftermath of the Delhi bombings could create a potentially dangerous rift between India's Muslims and the rest of the country.
This might lead to a kind of a perception about us and about the region, about the people of the region, which is not justified, which is not correct.
India's Muslims are underrepresented in the corridors of power. Even so, says Zilli, they see themselves as every bit as patriotic as the crowd singing the national anthem on Anti-Terrorist Day. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. This Friday evening, the fourth annual Tournai French Film Festival opens at Boardman's Art Theater in downtown Champaign. The festival, which runs through Thursday, November 6th, is organized by the University of Illinois and Parkland College. During the week-long fest, seven films will be screened. With me in the studio is Maggie Flynn. She's an assistant professor in the Department of French and the Unit for Cinema Studies at the U of I, and she's here to tell us more about the festival.
Thanks, Celeste.
Good to see you.
Yeah.
Is the festival open to the general public?
Absolutely.
Very good.
I mean, anyone, everyone, there's something for everyone. So,
and this year, there are two children's films, although these films will delight everybody, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these are films that I certainly grew up on. They had a huge distribution in the United States in the 1950s. Well, the Red Balloon did. On 16 millimeters. So this was something, you know, that people who are from their sort of late 20s through about 40, 45 just saw every year in school, mm-hmm. in elementary school. But they've been restored recently and re-released. And they're just great. I rewatched both the Red Balloon and White Mane, who are by the same director. The Red Balloon is, you know, it's a Paris tale, kind of quintessential Paris tale of a little boy and a balloon who follows him around. And the other is a story of a little boy and a horse. It's set in the Camargue, so which is the Rhone Delta right on the Mediterranean. And beautiful, beautiful black and white. The White Mane is black and white. Beautiful scenery.
Mm. And of course, it's a story of a child and an animal.
Yeah.
It's got to be winning.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, it's kind of this. Both of these films are kind of, you know, you can't go wrong.
And both of these films, if I'm not mistaken, won awards both here in the U.S. and in France.
That's right. Both White Mane and Cannes won prizes at White Mane and the Red Balloon won prizes at Cannes. I'm getting things backwards. And also, the Red Balloon was nominated for won an Oscar for best screenplay. So they were very well, you know, received immediately and have continued to stay.
Yeah. At what age would a child have an appreciation for these two films?
You know, I don't know. I don't have kids, so I don't have the exact. I'm not sure I'd have the exact pinning. I'd say the Red Balloon would go younger. The White Mane is a little bit older. There's a little bit of kind of drama about this horse who's trying to be tamed. And we have set them up so that the Red Balloon shows first, and then there'll be an intermission. They're in a double feature because they're both medium length films, 35, 40 minute long. You know, parents can very easily kind of make a discreet exit if they think their kids has kind of had enough of sitting in the theater. Or
I would think elementary school age children.
I think that's the kind of key.
Second grade maybe and up. You don't want to bring them too little and they are, you know, they don't know what's going on.
I have a friend who has a child who's, I believe, four and
like the Red Balloon?
The Red Balloon. So, yeah, that certainly worked with their kid.
Now, would you give us a thumbnail description of a couple of the other films? Because there are five more.
Sure.
You got a couple of favorites. What? How about something really for the adults, too?
Well, one film that I'm really delighted we're able to show is Darat, Dry Season. It's a film about set in the aftermath of civil war in Chad, and incredibly taut storyline. You know, there's this problem of this young man who has been told by his grandfather that although the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Chad had kind of finished its work and everything is supposed to be in order, the person who killed this boy's father was never brought to any kind of justice. And the grandfather says, you have to take care of this. And this young man meets his father's killer and has a relationship of sorts with him. It's a very father-son sort of relationship. And I was on the edge of my seat the entire way through. Is how on earth could this resolve? And the reason I'm really happy we're able to show this is a Franco-Chadian co-production, is that it's extremely rare. This is something that, you know, you're not going to be able to just go to the video store and get to see this. It was also incredibly expensive because it was so rare. So we're only showing that three times. So we usually show things four or even five in the past. So it's something to keep an eye on when it's available. The other film that's a little bit more special is the documentary film. Her name is Sabine, which people might know the actress Sandrine Bonnaire, who's been very popular since the 1980s. And this is her first, she's the director.
Uh-huh.
This is her first film, and it's about her sister who has autism. And it's, you know, this was the sister, Sabine, was not diagnosed for a very long time. And it's a kind of a mixture of home movies that Sandrine Bonnaire had made as the girls were, you know, younger, and growing up and contemporary footage. She made this as a militant film actually because, she felt like her sister had kind of slipped through the cracks too long and been not ill-diagnosed, and there wasn't the kind of support, institutional support. So with this, we actually have a panel discussion on Monday at the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities, which has people from cinema studies, but also people who we have someone who works on, knows a lot about autism in the United States as public health point of view. So that's Monday, the 3rd of November at noon.
Will there be any pre- or post-screening discussions at Boardman's?
Absolutely. Each film, except for the kids' films, all the other films are going to be introduced at least once. by a faculty member from Illinois or Parkland College. Just a, you know, brief introduction to kind of give you a little bit more context and nifty production anecdotes and that kind of thing, cultural context, those sorts of things.
Okay. Now, does one buy a pass or may we buy tickets for individual films?
Tickets are on sale individually, and they're actually up on the Boardman's website now. They are on sale. So that's www.boardmansarttheater, and that's R-E at the end of theater.com.
Boardmansarttheater.com.
So those are available now. And certainly on Friday night and on Saturday night, the 7 o'clock showings have been very, very, very busy in the past. So it's worth either coming by whenever the box office is open and buying the tickets or buying them online.
Yeah, it's really grown into a very popular festival.
Yeah, we have
festival.
2,500 people last year came. So we're very pleased. It gets a little bit bigger every year. We're competing with Halloween this year. We hope that people will be able to kind of come on in and not just on their way to or from their party or their trick-or-treating, but that and, of course, the elections on Tuesday.
Yeah, well, what a welcome diversion.
Yeah, I hope
there
so.
There we go. This Friday evening, the 4th annual Tournée French Film Festival opens at Boardman's Art Theater in downtown Champaign. The festival, which runs through Thursday, November 6th, is organized by the University of Illinois and Parkland College. 7 films will be screened during the week-long fest. And for more information, visit www.boardmansarttheater.com. And my thanks this afternoon to Maggie Flynn. Thanks,
Thank
Maggie.
Thank you, Celeste.
Earth and sky.
Some of the best engineers in the world coming together thought that solving environmental problems is the greatest challenge that faces the engineering community.
You're listening to Calestous Juma, professor of the practice of international development at Harvard University. In a meeting headed by the U.S. National Academy of Engineering, Juma and other scientists identified what they call the grand challenges for engineering in the 21st century.
I think one of the most exciting developments is the area of drought-tolerant crops. As we look into the future and large parts of the world that are not able to grow food at the moment.
Juma said that plants, such as corn, are being developed with genetic modification to resist drought, not only in Africa, but elsewhere around the world. And it's not just for food.
But also being able to do revegetation in areas that previously didn't hold any vegetation. So we are looking into a future where water may be a serious problem.
Another engineering challenge for the world is in infrastructure, which Juma said could benefit from stronger, lighter, and more durable materials.